Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I am Bob Hill.
And today on the show, you know, we can't ignore Derby altogether, although it has officially passed, Bob. But mint, of course, is something that I'm sure many people enjoyed yesterday, and maybe are scratching their head as to why they enjoyed too much of it.
Perhaps the worst drink in the history of civilization, but it's part of the Derby.
It's part of the Derby. So, Barbara Lawton's joining us. She's somewhat of a mint expert.
Very much so. She's written like 1,500 articles on different things. She wrote a book about mint, and very interesting woman. She's an answer lady from Missouri Botanic Gardens, so she has a very broad-based knowledge of plants and mints, and we're going to talk to her and find out more about them.
Sounds good. And we're going to head out to Thieneman's Herbs and Perennials to get some help from Gary Millwood. Each year, he selects, with Peggy Thieneman out there, different heirloom tomatoes, you know, to offer up for sale. And they've been doing it for quite a few years. And, you know, it's sort of a big deal. Tomato Days. It starts like the last Saturday in April. And honestly, so many people do sort of time their tomato planting till, you know, right after Derby.
Yeah.
Sort of makes sense. So we're going to head out there to see what different heirlooms are going to be offered up this year. And Gary's really good at, you know, knowing the qualities of each particular plant, so he can give us a rundown. So certainly there's an heirloom taste variety for everybody's kitchen use.
And Thieneman's just a fun place for herbs anyway. It's great. You know, there's Carol and Bud and Sharon and Kevin and Peggy, and they all know their stuff. And it's like a family of plant lovers out there. So it's just kind of fun to go out and learn about more stuff.
Lots of good plants out there. So we're looking forward to that. We hope that you'll stick with us today on Homegrown. Bob, what's going on in your garden?
Well, I'm starting to stake my trees that got bent over in the ice. You know, I thought they'd come back on their own a little bit, and some of them are and some aren't, so I'm giving them a help.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people should think about that maybe. Some of mine were like 30 degrees, listing starboard or port, whatever way you want to go.
Like kind of uprooted a little bit, you mean, or just?
Not uprooted, but just a tad. But mostly they're just bent that way from the ice and never came back up.
Okay.
And so, you know, there's a whole trick to staking trees properly and using kind of soft material that doesn't damage the tree.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working on that. And my arborvitaes are still about 45 degrees. So I'm literally tying them together for the time being. I don't know if the arborists recommend that, but I do. It works, and I'll take the ropes off eventually. But I've given them a little time to come back on their own. But I'm just kind of giving them a little bit of help. It's like helping your kids, you know, a little bit.
Shape up a little bit.
Yeah, and even the ewes. Some of my ewes were bent, and I'm bringing those back up. So I'm just, anyway, I'm pushing things a little bit, but I'm not going to hurt them. I'm going to help them.
Yeah.
It's tough love. Actually, it's soft love.
It's soft love.
Yeah. How about the Wish You Stay? What's up?
Well, you know, speaking of trees, we finally had some arborists come out that specialize in rigging and climbing, you know, because we had all these hangers and trees that needed to be taken down that were in areas where you couldn't get big trucks. So they were perfect. And it was amazing to watch these guys just like climbing trees. Like on the tip top of these humongous trees.
And no safety net?
Oh, of course. They know how to do all the I mean, no safety net, but, you know, they rig themselves to the trees in a very safe fashion and all of that. But it was just truly an art form.
It wasn't a bucket.
It was not a bucket. It was people climbing in trees with little chainsaws and doing a beautiful job of cleaning up the, you know, stuff that we just can't do.
And living to tell about it.
Yeah. But as a consequence, we have, they chipped up, you know, what they cut down. So we have piles of wood chips, of course. And I was talking to Corey, who's with the Limb Walkers, about just the whole concept of using fresh wood chips as mulch, because the whole thing that we've been taught about, you know, leaching nitrogen out of the soil. And yeah, it's ideal to let your piles sit for a couple of months to let it age a little bit so it won't do that. But we sort of concluded, in terms of other people that we've talked to and things that have been done, is that ultimately the wood chips, even if they leach a little nitrogen out of the soil initially, they're going to improve and condition the soil ultimately. So yeah, if they can sit for a little while, great. But if not, do not hesitate to use them, because he was talking about some arborists that have used wood chips for conditioning purposes and how after a year, how much the soil had improved and previously compacted areas for trees. And there's so much of it right now that we really should use it to our advantage and, you know, help to improve the soil. So.
Yeah, I've done that quite a bit too this year with chips I had. And it does work. You walk around, after 2 or 3 years, it gets soft and mushy, then it kind of disappears.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's dirt.
Right. And
that's how it works.
Because, you know, the first year that we did the vegetable garden, all the fresh wood chips were put down in the paths.
Right.
And what, that was 2 years ago? So this year's my second round at putting fresh wood chips, or new wood chips, you know, adding wood chips is what I should say. So, you know, you can count on it for at least a good 2 years as being really viable, good. And as it's there, it is improving the soil, which is the whole point.
Yeah, it's kind of like watching soil in the woods be developed in a microcosm, but instead of taking a million years, you're taking five.
Right.
But that's how you get...
Beautifully put, all that good decaying organic matter.
That's where it goes.
Ain't nothing like it. So, yeah, that's what's going on in my garden. There's other things going on around town as well, Bob. Some perennial events, of course. The Locust Grove Gardeners Fair is always takes place over that Mother's Day weekend. So May 8th, 9th, and 10th, you can head out to Locust Grove and enjoy that. The Louisville Nature Center is having their native plant sale May 9th from 9 to 4. And let's see, Just Creations is having their spring garden event. They do this every year. It starts at noon. I'll be there at 1 talking. I usually go out there and hang out for a while. And then they're also going to have extension information and potting activities for adults and children. So they're expanding it a little bit as well.
And it'll be 1 p.m. on what day?
All of that is May 9th.
Also on May 9th, as luck would have it, the Bloomfest of Bernheim Research Forest and Arboretum is going on. And also, the Bardstown Road Farmers Market is open from 8 to noon at the Presbyterian Church.
All right. Farmers markets are starting to open around town.
Must be spring.
Must be spring, indeed. All right. Another thing that starts to pop up in spring, Bob, is all the mint. It's one of those things that's the great thing about mint, but also the bad thing about mint. It really likes to spread itself, wouldn't you say?
Yes, absolutely.
So, you know, making sure that you contain it well may be one consideration. But there's more to mint than just the plain old garden mint that we found in our mint juleps over the weekend. And Barbara Lawton is joining us to explain.
That's right, Miss Wishy. Garden writer and speaker Barbara Lawton has published more than 1,500 articles, unbelievable, over her long career. Has volunteered answering questions as the plant doctor at the Missouri Botanical Garden for almost 20 years and has authored more than a half dozen garden books on many subjects, including a book titled Mints, A Family of Herbs and Ornamentals. She's with us today to talk about mints, those served in drinks, as well as compliments to the more land-based foods. Barbara, welcome to Homegrown.
Well, thank you, Bob, and I'm glad to be here with you.
I did some research on mint that goes back, my gosh, thousands of years. Kind of fill us in on what you know.
Indeed it does. Herbs have been known to be with man as long as written history. One of the first references was with the ancient Egyptians, and that, of course, was hundreds of years B.C. And there's been signs that herbs have been used medicinally. Herbs in the mint family have been used medicinally way back then, and the history of mints with mankind is long and important, and they've been our partners in the kitchen and in medicine for thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
With the very recent Kentucky Derby, you'd be very interested to know, I'm sure, that because of Spearmint's association with mint juleps, during Prohibition, spearmint was so strongly linked with that bourbon drink that mint beds were dug up and ripped out in several southern states, including Virginia.
Oh, my. Huh.
Can you believe it?
I can hardly believe it. Those prohibitionists. No fun. Barbara, what sort of, I guess, defines or classifies the mint family? Because it's a pretty big family. What do you have to be to be a part of it?
It is a very big family. And people keep thinking that the mint family is just spearmint.
Mm-hmm.
And the keys to the mint family are square stem, leaves that are equal and opposite, and flowers that have a definite lip to them. All you have to do is look at any flowering member of the mint family, and you will see the characteristics that make that a lipped flower.
Hmm.
People always think of the mint family as being just spearmint, and that's not true. It includes all of the major herbs, rosemary, thyme, basil, lavender.
Let's talk about mint itself. What is it about mint that makes it what it is, the various oils and so forth?
Well, the mint, the stronger smelling and tasting mints include volatile oils that are very, very strong. The smell, once you learn the smells of the various mints and herbs in the mint family, you'll never get them confused with anything else. They just are, I find them wonderful. They have a flavor and a taste and a fragrance all their own, and it is these attributes that have made them very valuable in medicine and in the kitchen as well.
Well, were those flavors of a defensive mechanism or to keep bugs away or to bring bugs in or both? Or do you know?
Well, people aren't aware of it particularly, but if you have a strong-smelling member of the mint family like sage or spearmint, you can repel insects by taking a few leaves and rubbing them between your hands and rubbing them on your face, on the skin, and that will repel insects. Deer don't eat members of the mint family also, which is a very nice attribute these days.
Okay, let's talk about some mints in the garden, some common mints in the garden. Which ones would you recommend to people if you wanted to grow five mints to begin with?
Well, as far as mints in the garden, there are some mints that are generally used primarily in the garden for their ornamental value, and that would include Monarda and Skullcap, things like that. I also find using some of the regular herbs in the garden. I have mixed gardens. I use a garden kitchen sage, Salvia officinalis. I use that as a shrub out front, and it has very beautiful flowers in the late spring. And I use Monarda, that's bee balm, that's mint family, and that has a number of different cultivars, some white, some pink, some red, and that also was used in early days by pioneers for a tea that was also very soothing.
So, Barbara, understanding that the mint family is a very large family, and I think a lot of people are surprised that rosemary and thyme and Monarda and all these different things are part of that family. Let's sort of, I guess, step back in that more traditional notion of what mint is. You had mentioned spearmint, and I know that, you know, there's variations on the theme. You can get variegated, wintergreen types of scents.
Well, this is
true. Sort of
they've been around with mankind so long that plant breeders, of course, have come up with variations that were sometimes sports. They just occurred who knows why, and then were propagated. And other times they have been bred on purpose. The origin of a lot of these, like the pineapple mint and apple mint and curly mint, the origin of these is kind of lost in history. They've been grown for so long.
Okay. So what about, like, if we just look at that traditional sort of mint taste, right?
You mean you're talking about true mints now?
True mints, that traditional mint taste.
Okay, that would be the spearmint and peppermint, that kind of thing.
So give us kind of a snapshot of the different plants that are going to give us that traditional sort of mint taste.
Well, that would be the peppermints and the spearmints and the variations on those themes. And these plants are among the ones that some people say, oh, I wouldn't have that in my garden. It spreads too much. Well, it may spread a lot and spread fast. That can be an attribute as well.
Right.
It's also shallow-rooted and easy to pull up.
Right.
I myself grow the true mints in containers, and they're wonderful. I wouldn't have a kitchen without the true mints. They're great in tea and lemonade, as well as mint juleps, of course.
So what's the difference? Because I've got, you know, the garden mint, which I guess is what you're referring to as spearmint, right? So,
well,
spearmint
and peppermint, I think
they're
all
mint
family.
But what's the difference between the various species? Anything?
Well, they're just different species and have different attributes.
Okay.
Let's see, I'm checking in my book right now to see what in heaven's name I said about that. Mentha, the mint genus, the true mints, is undoubtedly the best known. It includes some 25 aromatic annuals or perennials, most of which came from Eurasia and Africa. Terminal spikes include many flowers, usually white to lavender, and you can propagate them easily by cuttings. Pennyroyal is a true mint,
okay,
and that has a scent that's very strong and the smooth leaves are up to an inch long and maybe slightly dentate, that notched, and the lilac or white flowers appear in late spring.
Yeah, that one's got a Kentucky flavor, too, because the western part of the state's called the Pennyrhyal area, and that's that mint that grows wild out there.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I'm sure it's gone wild. But Mentha spicata is spearmint, and that's the best known. It's thought to be have come from Europe and can be found wild throughout Europe.
Mm-hmm.
A rambling perennial, toothed, lanceolate leaves, normally smooth, with a very strong characteristic scent, and summer flowers appear in spikes, maybe white, pink, or violet. So you see, different. Well, then there's apple mint right below that, and that has fuzzy leaves.
And with an apple taste to it as well, I suspect.
Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
And
well,
scent.
Let's talk about the taste of mint and how, you know, good ways in which to cook with mint. What are some of your best recipes out of the mint garden?
Well, I use everything from rosemary to basil to thyme and all of those things in cooking generally. And, well, of course, basil is called the tomato herb because it goes so well with sliced tomatoes in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, I have my first crop of basil growing. I can see it right now from here. And I'll be using that all through the summer in salads and with tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, there's other herbs that, like rosemary, goes with just about anything and is particularly well-known to go with lamb and fish. Savory is called the green bean herb, both winter savory and summer savory. And with good meaning, the savory goes so well with green beans. Again, a wonderful, wonderful homegrown crop of green beans spiced up with a little winter or summer savory can be just great.
How about cooking with the true mints?
I don't use them in cooking so much. I use them in as I said before, everything from plain water to lemonade to iced tea.
Okay, so with beverages.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Goes well with gin and tonic.
Ah, very good idea.
I was going to ask you, is there any other drinks besides the mint julep where mint is used specifically? Gin and tonic's obviously one. Anything else?
Oh, I think you could use any of those strong true mints in any drinks you wanted to make.
All right. That's my kind of herb.
And still drink it. Huh?
There's even a chocolate mint that would go well in hot chocolate.
All right.
That's a thought. Well, before we go, let's talk about your book a little bit. Mints, A Family of Herbs and Ornamentals. How'd that get put together? What'd you do for that?
Well, I'd always wanted to write more about the mints, and I worked for the Missouri Botanical Garden years ago. And as I learned more about all plants working there, I grew even fonder of this mint family. And as I learned more about it, I realized that I'd really love to write a book about these herbs sometime. And as fate would have it, I contacted Timber Press, and they thought it was a pretty good idea, and I launched into writing that. And let's see, when was it first published? It was first published in 2002. So from 2000 to 2002, I was working pretty heavily on that and did a lot of research down at the garden, Botanical Garden itself, as well as, of course, in libraries and internet sources.
Well, good. Well, thank you very much. We sure enjoy talking to you, and good luck.
Well, I thank you.
Garden writer Barbara Lawton is author of the book Mints, A Family of Herbs and Ornamentals. For more information on her book or mints, visit the homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Derby weekend is tomato planting time for many, so we visit Tomato Days at Thiedemann's Herbs and Perennials coming up after the break. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
And I'm Bob Hill, and there's nothing for a garden geek that's more fun than being in a place like this where there's, everywhere you look, there's old buildings and plants and trays and pots and potting soil, and just feels like
it does. And there's about every kind of plant that you might desire here. This is my favorite place to come for perennials and herbs. It's Thieneman's Herbs and Perennials, and we came here to visit with Peggy Thieneman, who's president out here, as well as Gary Millwood. But Tomato Days, which started last weekend, April 25th, sort of a tradition now at Thieneman's. What they've started to do is tomato consultant Gary Millwood, he and Peggy plan each year and select different heirloom tomatoes and some other vegetables as well. Gary does the research on the heirlooms, and then Peggy and the greenhouse staff grow them. So we wanted to come out and, you know, see what was going to be available this year. An heirloom, something that's, you know, every year gets more popular than ever, really. But I wanted to sort of touch base with you, Peggy. You know, thanks for having us out here, of course. You've been doing it, gosh, I want to say close to a decade. What inspired you sort of before everybody else to get involved in the whole heirloom tomato thing?
Well, because of our long history with herb plants, we've become inveterate collectors with different groups of plants. Mm-hmm. And about 8 or 9 years ago, my uncle introduced me to Tomato Growers magazine, and I could not believe the numbers of varieties of tomatoes, because when we were growing up, you know, there was Better Boy, Big Boy, Winsall, Ponderosa.
Right.
And so I found out that there were purple tomatoes and yellow tomatoes and pear tomatoes and cherry tomatoes, and it got bad quick.
or good, as the case may be.
Right.
And you guys are perfectly equipped to do, you know, something on a little bit more of a significant scale, because you have all the greenhouses. I mean, one of the things you do is start plants from cuttings and seeds and whatnot. So, you know, that first year, how did you just, like, pick out stuff? Did your Uncle Earl help you pick out stuff in terms of what you wanted to grow? I mean, what was the method?
Basically, I went through the catalog, and I started reading the descriptions, and I picked descriptions from there, or varieties from there. Mm-hmm. We started with about 50 or 60 different varieties of tomatoes, and we thought that was, you know, the be-all and end-all of selection. Mm-hmm. And since that time, the collection has grown based on requests from customers, mm-hmm. and I was astounded at the number of people who are interested in these oddball things.
Well, Peggy, how geographic can they be? Do you have tomatoes like from Minnesota to Florida to Carolina to Missouri, or pretty much in the Kentucky area?
Usually the tomatoes that are listed in catalogs will list days to maturity, mm-hmm. and we kind of go by that, mm-hmm. to make sure that we have a long enough growing season for them.
Okay. So, in just the logistics of it all, Peggy, with the greenhouses and starting the tomatoes, you get the seeds in about what time of the year and plant them out, success rate, seeds, what do you have to do to sort of get these plants to a decent size, you know, for sale?
We also grow a lot of odd varieties of peppers, and this year we put it on the calendar. We start the peppers January the 20th in the greenhouses. Mm-hmm. And the tomatoes, generally, we would like to have them started as early as February the 20th. They get transplanted when they're about 2 or 3 inches tall, maybe in a month's time, and then we grow them out from there. Some of the seed we didn't get until a bit later, and so the tomatoes got started a little bit later. Mm-hmm. But February the 20th is a benchmark that we look at.
Okay. And then they're out by the end of April, ready to be sold.
Right.
Okay.
And you rotate some new ones in and old ones out every year just to keep the thing fresh, so to speak?
We try to keep an idea of how many of different varieties we sold. If we were long on a variety, we're going to drop that one. We're going to try something new. Mm-hmm. We have tried a couple of really, really popular hybrids and some really, really new varieties that come out. And then Gary, of course, always comes up with some really oddball mm-hmm. thing that he's found somewhere. So we always like to try that one.
Right.
Like last year was the stick tomato.
I got that one year. Yeah, I remember that stick tomato.
Could you even guess how many tomatoes you'll sell in a year, the heirlooms? How many go through here in your tomato days?
She's thinking.
She's still thinking.
We have they're in trays of 18 apiece.
Right.
And we have about 150 varieties.
Oh, my gosh.
Wow.
And we have at least two trays of each variety. So somebody with a math degree can do that figuring.
All right.
1.6 million. I just did it.
All right. So that's sort of a little bit of the history from 50 different varieties to 150 different varieties in nearly a decade. But I think the man behind some of that expansion is with us, Gary Millwood. Gary, how do you fit into this? There was somewhat of a serendipitous meeting between you and Thienemann's Herbs and Perennials 9 years ago, huh?
Yes, I retired. I had to retire because of heart problems, and being retired with medical problems brings other problems with it.
Sure.
And so I was sitting at home one day and thought, well, I need to do something, and gardening was one of my favorite things to do before I was sick. And so thought I'd grow heirloom tomatoes, and checked around, and the county agent didn't know anyone who was handling them, mm-hmm. and came by Thienemann's, and they had a nice selection, and I took a look at them, and they asked me to come back the next day to help them, help the people who were coming to select varieties. Mm-hmm. So I've been doing it. This is the ninth year.
So how did you amass the body of knowledge of heirloom tomatoes? I hear the story is that you were able to almost identify and name and describe every variety.
Sort of like a sponge. I'm looking for something that people have enjoyed. And my grandfather farmed, and I spent some time in visiting with them on the farm and learned about growing tomatoes, mm-hmm. and did it as an adult. But I belong to a couple of groups, belong to CHOPTAG, which is Cincinnati Open Pollinated Heirloom Tomato Growers Associates.
Okay.
And we meet twice a year, and in the spring we meet for plant exchange of tomato plants. And these are generally rare to very rare, and then some common ones. Mm-hmm. And then in the summer we meet for a tomato tasting, which is the most fun because we get to sample all the different varieties.
Well, Gary, how do you define an heirloom tomato? What is it? What does it take?
Well, an heirloom, if you think back to your grandparents and your great-grandparents period, they grew mostly tomatoes that were available to them, and they saved them from year to year. And so it's good to find a family variety that it's been in a family for a long period of time and has some history, and you want to have it to fall into at least a 50-year period.
Okay.
So that
having been around for at least 50 years. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I just found a tomato that was brought to me from Ohio, and I'm looking forward to growing it this year. It is Aunt Lou's tomato. Uh-huh. It's a great aunt of a gentleman, elderly gentleman, in Ohio, and she got it from a gentleman, a black gentleman, mm-hmm. who either was or had been a slave in Kentucky. And he moved from Kentucky either by the Underground Railroad or just after the Civil War to Ohio. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really excited about that one.
Is it possible to guess how many heirloom tomatoes there are in the country?
Oh, there are probably 5,000 or more. Mm-hmm. It's just hard to keep up with all of them. But
because of the interest now, at least there's probably better documentation and I guess more dispersal, really, more people growing them.
Yes,
so
sir.
Will that help or hurt sort of the profile of an heirloom?
Seed Savers Exchange in Iowa was one of the first ones that they have a group, a membership that grow tomato seed and share them with members of the organization. Mm-hmm. Some of the seed companies, of course, the old seed companies were growing things that were available at that time, and they just put them on the market. The more recent commercial varieties were mostly hybrid types. Now, there were some like the New Yorker and Valiant. We have New Yorker this year. I don't think we have Valiant, but those are two favorite old ones. Marglobe and Rutgers are good, and they are from a period of time before the hybridization, like in the late 30s or 40s, when they came into being.
I'm curious, what's the biggest garden you've been to? How many individual heirloom tomatoes in one place have you ever seen?
I have a friend, and he depends on me for finding him a new variety. In Ohio, he and two of his friends grow about 400 varieties of tomatoes a year.
Wow.
And there's a guy in Illinois that I have contact with, and he grows 400 varieties each year, and he lists 800 or 1,000 varieties with Seed Savers Exchange.
Wow. All right, so Tuthenamans, 150 varieties you'll be able to find here this year. What's the process like, Gary, for you and Peggy each year as you decide and find which heirlooms you're going to actually grow for that season?
Well, we depend upon the preference that people have had and how popular a particular tomato variety was a particular year, mm-hmm. and we try to have those available, and we also will look for things that are new.
Old but new, right?
Well, old but new, yeah. J.D.'s Texas Special is a black one, deep purple black, mm-hmm. and it was my favorite tomato last year, and it was probably the most requested tomato in the country besides Sun Gold, which is a hybrid cherry. But then we sort of augment with other things by looking through catalogs. And you were talking about the stick tomato. We don't have that one this year, but we have lychee. And lychee is in the tomato family, in the nightshade family. And it has stickers and has a little coating on it like tomatillo.
Uh-huh.
And
papery-like.
The stickers, you have to wear gloves to pick the mm-hmm. tomatoes.
August Moon has a lychee martini, and that's why I know what that is, the little fruit that they have there. Not that I drink it, but I have seen that fruit. So Peggy allows you the, I guess, indiscretion of picking out something kooky every year to add to the
heirloom. Yeah, we just sort of think, oh, there's another one I like, and it's a pretty good one, is the one from New Jersey, mm-hmm. a tomato. They have, like, the State Fair. And they have all of their largest tomato entries, and then when the entry is over, and they have a winner, they put all those tomatoes together and save the seed. And so for the last two or three years, we've had New Jersey champion tomatoes. Now I don't know whether it'll be red or yellow or whatever color, but that's sort of, some people grow tomatoes just for the size and try to enter it in competitions and things like that.
I was curious about that. How do you avoid cross-fertilization? How do you protect and preserve these seeds of the heirloom tomatoes?
Well, most people don't consider saving seed. There are two or three different methods. One is to plant a large number of the same variety in one area. Another one is to isolate them in another area without the other tomatoes being around. Mm-hmm. They are self-fertilizing. They start fertilize themselves, but the best way is to bag them with a bag like a tulle or organza or something mm-hmm. that allows some breathing of it.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, you had mentioned how some people grow tomatoes for just the size. Mm-hmm. Some people are going to grow certain varieties because they taste a certain way. Mm-hmm. You know, more acidic, less acidic, sweet, et cetera, size-wise, color, all of those things. So, Gary, can you give us a little bit of a snapshot of some of the different heirlooms and the stories behind them and then the culinary value that they will provide in terms of the ones that you chose this year?
Well, I kept in mind this year because of what the economic situation is, and we've been mindful of how much things are costing and people are interested in growing and preserving. And so this year we have about 20 varieties of paste and processing tomatoes for those people who want to preserve for the winter. We always like to have a variety of cherry tomatoes, and of course slicers are the most popular, but
are they finding new heirlooms, if you can say that, every year? Oh. They still keep surfacing from different places and unusual places?
Yes, there's a gentleman in California who is really making a name for himself, named Brad Gates. And he has been crossing tomatoes and getting stabilized tomatoes. And Berkeley tie-dye is one he has. I've seen it and tasted it, and it's very good, but I haven't grown it. I do have this year one of his tomatoes called Haley's Purple Comet, and we grew that last year and maybe even the year before, but it's sort of a small-sized tomato, about the size, maybe less than a tennis ball size.
Any particular ones that are your favorite, or is that a unfair question to ask a heirloom tomato connoisseur like yourself?
A consultant at that.
I can't think of anything.
Any that you just can't live without?
I don't believe I know of any particular one.
Champagne.
Oh, the champagne cherry. I have a friend in Cleveland, Ohio. She's going to be here this week. And she sent me seed for champagne cherry. Now, she grows for the chefs in the Cleveland area. And it was a very difficult tomato to find.
So a champagne-colored cherry tomato, I suspect?
It's a light, creamy, white-looking tomato. And we have a small tomato that is called Red Robin. And it only gets about 12 inches high. You can put that in a small container and keep it on the patio or the windowsill outside, and it'll just produce for you.
Well, Gary, how big is your tomato patch, and do you have trouble every August like the rest of us giving them away at some point?
I did grow a number of tomatoes, but I'm growing in containers now, and you don't get the kind of production in containers that you just keep struggling with it. But depend on my foster tomato growers.
Yeah, live vicariously through the other.
Oh,
other
they bring me 2 and 3 pounders, you know, which is really neat. And we've got some Sicilian saucer will get to be like 3 to 4 pounds if it's getting the right nutrients and everything.
Mm-hmm. Sort of another special thing that you guys have done that's new this year is you've collected and grown heirloom tomatoes that are specifically from Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
So can you tell us a little bit about what that lineup looks like?
I share a lot of my good tomatoes with a friend who is a master grower. His name is Marilyn Needens, and he grows tomatoes and he distributes them to two seed companies in particular, Baker Creek and Southern Exposure Seed Exchange in Virginia. And right now, we have listed better than a dozen varieties that we've introduced, and most of them are Kentucky varieties.
Are there places people can go in late summer to see all these tomatoes lined up in a row so you can look at them and enjoy the experience?
Yes, you can go to Raleigh, North Carolina, where I've been for the summer, and that's probably the biggest one. Last year, they had people flying from Australia to visit there and to help. You can go to Detroit. I have friends who have a group there that they grow. You can go to Upper State New York. There's a group that meets up there. There's a group that meets in Omaha, Nebraska. There's a group that meets in Mountain something in South Carolina. He's a friend of mine. And
you haven't mentioned Kentucky or Indiana yet. We got to get going on this.
I don't know of one in Indiana, and I don't know of one in Kentucky either.
So somebody needs to have a tomato tasting festival somehow. Yeah.
Well, we tried that last year, the year before, and just a few people showed up. But you have to really be interested in growing and sharing them, and then coming in and sharing them with other people to get the taste of them.
Well, let's see. It's tomato planting time in Kentucky because the Derby's over. So if you're interested in heirloom vegetables, because you guys have added additional heirloom vegetables to the list. It's not just tomatoes, right, Peggy?
Right. We have a pretty decent assortment of odd peppers also.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily heirlooms, but there's been a lot of interest in hot peppers.
Mm-hmm.
So we have an assortment of those also.
Okay. Any tomatillos this year?
Green. Yeah. We have tomatillas.
Good, because you're the only place I can find tomatillas, so I'll be back for sure.
They're yummy.
They are yummy. Thank you both very much. We really appreciate your
time.
Thank
you very much.
All right. Tomato days started last week, so come on out to Thienemann's Herbs and Perennials. They're located on Blowing Tree Road, which is pretty much the last green space left in the Hurstbourne area, just off the corner of Taylorsville Road and Hurstbourne Parkway. And, of course, for more information, you can check out our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, a few listener questions and Miss Wishy's new Latin Word of the Week. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
We have some great questions again.
We do have some great questions
but
again.
Before we get we also have a comment.
Yes.
We should mention this. A man named Mike Upsell, who's an old buddy of mine from the Courier-Journal, we had a show on a while back about ornamental fruits in the yard. He uses both ornamentals and edible. He said we neglected the serviceberry.
Mm.
And I think we did, too. It is pretty common around here, but Mike has one about 10 feet high, 10 feet across. He says his berries are the size of blueberries, a bit redder in color, similar in taste to a blueberry, but with a nutty finish. Mm-hmm. And the plant's prolific. We and a neighbor picked quarts and quarts of berries last year, even sharing with the birds.
I was going to say he's lucky because usually the cedar waxwing come in and
yeah, I know it.
Take their pick.
It's great on cereal or ice cream, would probably make a fine preserve, and I think it does actually.
Yeah.
So we neglected service berries, and Mike, we apologize, and we'll be out.
And it's a great tree to boot.
Yep, we'll be out this fall to get some.
There we go. No, actually, they ripen up in the summer.
Yeah.
Yeah, so earlier than other
That's
types
true.
Of fruits. But, you know, a lot of fruit ripens up earlier anyway.
And then the fall color.
And then the fall color, definitely. And along the same lines, Bob, here's a question from Katie Matthews. She's interested in growing goji plants, and gojis are kind of like all the rave lately.
Yeah, right.
All the rage, all the rave.
Yeah.
There, people are raving about them. They're all the rage because of health benefits, basically.
Right.
So people are starting to become interested in growing this plant, although I do not know that much about growing it at all. I've never grown it, and I don't know if anybody who grows it around here. But her question ultimately is, she has a sunny backyard. So she wants to plant some, and she wants it to sort of grow up onto her deck. She's researched it quite a bit. Her question is there any reason that I should not plant this non-native fruit tree, other than the obvious, the non-native part? Thanks for your advice, Katie. And, I mean, in my mind, no, there's no reason in the world you shouldn't try to grow it and plant it. There's nothing that suggests to me that it's an invasive plant.
No.
There's lots of fruiting plants that are non-natives that we enjoy in our landscapes. So, you know, I wouldn't let that hold you back. That's kind of up to you and your garden philosophy.
And I Googled it up and got some information on it, too. And it's a native of, you know, Asia, maybe the Himalayas, Southwest Asia, and Southeastern Europe. So it might be kind of warm here for it. You can find out. But what I'd like her to just try it and call us back or let us know by the end of the summer.
Yeah, and it's supposed to be real drought tolerant once it's established, but key once it's established. So, you know, baby the first couple of years, and then it should do okay. And let us know if the heat and humidity of the summer kind of poops it out a little
bit. It's got a pretty flower.
Yeah, it's very pretty.
It's an interesting plant.
And pretty fruit. Yeah. So. All right, here's another question, Bob. Let's see. This one's from Christine. She planted some black raspberries a couple of years ago, and they did really well the first year.
Uh-oh.
And then the years after that, they started to decline.
The bad news.
So she noticed that the canes were afflicted with something. Look at the underside of the leaves, and they'd have like a rusty sort of material on it. She was careful about cutting out the old canes, but this, like last year, they didn't get anything at all. So her question is, what can she plant in this area? She's really, you know, improved the area, good compost, that sort of thing. So she doesn't want to want the area to go to waste. She has some thornless Natchez blackberries that someone gave her, but she's not sure if they should be planted there. She was also thinking about grapes. Any other suggestions? And really, the only thing that I can say is you can plant anything there except brambles. I wouldn't plant any blackberries there because clearly the area, it does have some sort of persistent disease. Even some of the more disease-resistant varieties of blackberries and raspberries are still going to be susceptible if it's present. And that's just kind of the nature of the beast. They are susceptible to a multitude of diseases if it's not really clean. You can try grapes, but grapes can sort of be a pain too. I mean, other types of fruiting plants would be agreeable, wouldn't you think, Bob?
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, just try them, or maybe, I don't know how big your yard is. That's always a factor in these kind of things. But Yeah, anything but brambles, just try something else and maybe find some somewhere else in the yard.
Yeah, what other kind of fruits do you like? Do you like blueberries? Maybe you should try goji berries too.
Right.
But yeah, anything other than brambles at this
right.
point. So I know that may be disappointing, and then try to plant your blackberries somewhere else in the garden that's a cleaner spot. So
and it is hard to guess exactly what disease it is. She's orange speckles and those scab marks on the canes. But
definitely a type of rust disease.
Yeah. And Miss Wishy, another edible question, more or less, from Tana. Great name. An amateur gardener, her second year growing her own vegetable garden, would like to grow some peas this year. I read they do not grow well in climates over 70 degrees, which in Kentucky we know the temperatures climb well above that during the summer. What's the best information on growing peas? Is there a certain variety that tastes good and grows well in this area? Your expertise would be very helpful. Thank you for your time, Tana.
Hannah, I love, they also call those sweet peas English peas, or shelling peas, basically those that you would shell and eat as fresh peas. And last year we grew a variety called Mr. Big that was fabulous. I mean, they were huge peas and they were so good.
Cartoon character.
Yeah. So they did well for us. But here's the trick, Tana. At this point, you've waited a little too late to plant peas. Right. We put our peas out usually in mid-March. As you said, they like it cool, so you want to get them out as soon as possible so you can get, you know, a good crop out of them before they poop out in the middle of the summer, because at that point you're basically going to start pulling them out anyway. But if you get them in early, you'll be able to get a good crop. A couple of pointers: soaking the peas overnight before you plant them increases germination rates. Also using a bean and pea inoculant, you know, that has the mycorrhizal fungi stuff in it, helps germination and helps the peas actually set nodes so that you'll get a better yield. So soaking and using the inoculant will really kind of improve the season, if you will, get it started a little bit earlier and improve the yield in the long run.
Now, what about a fall crop of peas starting in October?
I have tried that and it doesn't work as well because basically the soil temperature is too hot. You know what I mean? So the germination rate is poor because the soil temperature is too hot.
Yeah.
So you're better off focusing on, you can try it, but you're just not going to get a real good germination. But your early crop is your best. So now, by mid-March next year, get your seeds in.
Yeah, well, I've always had less good luck with fall gardens than mm-hmm. spring gardens and the cool weather stuff for some reason. The timing's everything, I guess.
Yeah, it is.
And the sunshine and all that kind of stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, all right, if you've got questions, let us know. You can get a hold of us in a couple of different ways.
Yep. Visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org. Call us at 502-814-8246. Or write us a letter. It's been a while, and our mailbox is lonely. Bob or Janine, Homegrown, 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky, 40202. Miss Wishy, your Latin word of the week this week is something I've puzzled over several times myself, and I love your final description of it. I'm going to steal a little bit of your thunder, and you can build up to it and take it right back. It looks like a natural vase. It's a perfect description of this thing.
Yes, like a little natural vase.
Yeah.
The Latin word of the week this week is calycina, calycinus, or calycinum, and that means calyx-like. And I had to further, I felt inclined to, you know, define what calyx-like is, right?
Yeah.
So the calyx is the part of the plant. It's the outer set of envelopes, basically, that form or enclose at the base of the flower.
Mm-hmm.
It's usually, you know, more green and leaf-like, but sometimes it's colored.
Yeah.
So essentially, it's like the little vase that the flower is emerging out of.
Exactly.
That's the calyx. So calycina, calycinus, or calycinum is calyx-like. It's not necessarily the calyx, but it's calyx-like. So, for example, Aaron's beard, or Hypericum calycinum.
Right.
Okay. Agilinus, maybe?
Whatever you say, kid.
Agilinus, calycina, the Lyacida false foxglove. And think about what a foxglove looks like.
It does.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm looking at it.
You know that
it's
a very, in its true form, a very kind of pronounced calyx.
Right.
Calyx. So the false foxglove is going to have a calyx-like component to it, calycina. Sagittaria calycina.
The hooded arrowhead.
Hooded arrowhead. Arrowhead's a boggy plant, and that calycina sort of concept too, mm-hmm. you can think about hooded because it's going to look sort of like a calyx, but not
exactly.
underneath, right? That leafy sort of papery form. Rorypa calycina.
The persistent sepal yellow cress.
Persistent sepal yellow cress. Wow. How about that?
Sounds like a wedding dress or something.
It does.
The bride was wearing a persistent sepal yellow cress.
It does. Sabbatia calycina. And actually, I got out at Thienemann's a couple years ago, I got a Sabbatia from Peggy. Sabbatia calycina, coastal rose gentian.
Gentians,
too, if you think about the calyx there.
You have good
Very
luck with
pronounced.
Gentians.
No, I don't.
I don't either. I love them. Buddy.
Saxifraga calycina. Alaska saxifrag.
Yeah.
So there you go. Calycina, calycinus, or calycinum is calyx-like, and the calyx is that little natural vase, that papery, leafy thing that basically holds the flower bud onto the stem.
There are sometimes it's more interesting and pretty than the flower.
Sometimes it is.
Some flowers, some different plants.
That's right. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, a little mountaintop removal issues and an update on the emerald ash borer.
Homegrown is produced by that human vase of kindness, Brad Yost, in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.